Robbie's a cool professor. He's the guy who goes to class on a skateboard and crushes it.
I try. Right? I try.
And do you still do rap music in your classes?
I do. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I make them suffer through it.
Can you rap for us?
Oh, yeah. I'm on this Life Meet Tech with Prabhu, and I might speak next about the metaverse. Yes, I better curse. No, I better not. Or I best get a hearse.
I'm looking forward to season two and opening season two off with Robbie Rattan, who's going to be talking about the metaverse. Robbie, good to have you here. Robbie is associate professor in the Department of Media and Information at Michigan State University. He is an expert on the metaverse, from the BBC to local broadcasters. Everybody has been after Robbie to interview him and get his insights. So we're delighted to have you on the show, and let's get to the metaverse.
Let's get there.
Yeah.
And get me a ticket. Let's jump on the metaverse train.
So to get to the metaverse train, what are the steps? So where do you think we are, and what should happen?
Sure. Well, I believe we are not quite at the metaverse stage of this technology yet. We're at the metaphor that I always go back to is the internet, of course, because I was around before the internet was really a force in society in the early 90s. The internet, of course, existed, but very few people were on it. It was kind of clunky. Getting between websites or moving from servers to servers was difficult. So I think that's kind of where we are with the metaverse. The metaverse, I would define as an interoperable network of immersive virtual spaces. And so we do have immersive virtual spaces. We can jump in a VR headset and be there surrounded in a digital world. And that's an immersive experience, but it's not interoperable. It's not very easy to jump from one virtual world to another if it's outside of the same ecosystem. So I think that is an important distinction and an important defining characteristic of the metaverse, or will be a defining characteristic of the metaverse. The ability to go from, let's say, the Microsoft Teams virtual world with my colleagues meetings, work-oriented productivity suite, and jump over to, I don't know, the Microsoft Minecraft server or the Meta social space or the Snapchat world. the possibilities are endless, and the movement between metaverse spaces should be seamless, just like it is now. You jump in a web browser and you can move from one website to another. That's what I imagine, and I think many people imagine the metaverse will eventually be.
To get that kind of seamless interoperability, do you see that as a technical challenge or will of people who are all involved in this? Is there a financial component to it?
I think the answer is yes. It's a socio-technical and economic financial challenge. And the economic side of it actually relates to the social side of it in some ways. So we've talked about blockchain and cryptocurrencies for some time, and we've talked about the metaverse and virtual reality for some time. When those two things come together, those two kind of elements of technological development, that's when you really get Web 3.0, which is a buzzword, but what does it really mean? The ability to own digital objects through NFTs and cryptocurrency, which is all based on this public ledger blockchain technology, that facilitates interoperability in the metaverse. Because if you can prove that you own this avatar t-shirt or that virtual real estate, you can take it with you from one space to another. So it becomes easier. the metaphor I go back to for a media scholar like you, of course, this is easy to grasp, is interoperability with any mass medium technology, right? In the early days of radio, there weren't standards for radios to speak with each other, right? Like, what frequencies do we actually use? You needed organizations like the FCC to come together and say, this is the standard. A more common or recent example might be charger cables. 15 years ago, we had 100 different charger cables for cell phones. Now we've just got a few, the USB, the lightning cable. Standardization in mass communication, or really in any mass consumed technology, is essential for the ability to take advantage of economies of scale, for the price of production to go down. So there's this economic angle. So we need standardization in the ways that we kind of operate with these files and ownership of virtual objects, the crypto facilitated sale and purchase and consumption of virtual objects will allow us to standardize essentially across the metaverse landscape.
An integral part of interoperability then is crypto as well as blockchain, right? Because that's where commerce can happen in a very seamless way, which adds incentives for building this interoperable system.
Absolutely. That's the vision. That's the, I would say, medium-term vision. You know, 5 years out, we can imagine a metaverse that is highly integrated with that type of financial technology.
What I find extremely interesting about metaverse is it's virtual reality, is it not? It's a sense of presence. You gave me that Oculus glasses and I just put it on.
Yeah.
But I felt completely transported. I felt like I was in a whole different time and space. So tell us about this. There is an underlying psychology and there is so much to this. So unpack this for us.
Absolutely. I don't know if I told you the story. I was inspired into graduate studies by reading the book Snow Crash, which is the book that coined the term, Neal Stephenson coined, metaverse. And so this notion of presence is... it's a multifaceted notion. You can feel present in the moment. It's a temporal construct, but it's also a spatial construct. I feel like I'm present here with you in the studio, these bright lights, the black curtains. It's a pretty cool experience, actually. It's a unique presence for me. There's also social presence. We're sitting across from each other. If we weren't in the same room, I would still feel a significant level of social presence. We're communicating synchronously. But if we had VR headsets on, we could be across the planet from each other and still feel like we're right here, like sitting next to you here now. I feel more social presence than I would on a phone call, on a Zoom call. But in VR, you really feel like you're there with the other person. And we, as humans, are such social beings. We evolved to rely on social bonds for survival, for the ability to thrive, kind of pass our genes along and nurture our young, et cetera. The social group is essential. So it's no surprise then that technologies that enhance our sense of connection to other people are very popular. We see this with social media. We see this with online games. So the metaverse is taking advantage of that, like with online games, but now outside of a playful gaming context. Now it's just like social media, except instead of sending your grandkid pictures or having a video call with your family across the world, you can feel like you're sitting there together and chatting, having a work meeting, enhancing your productivity through that ability to feel like you can share virtual space and objects and time with people.
So let me pose you this question. Finding Nemo or Monsters, Inc., these are blockbuster movies, but they're also amazing movies. I mean, you totally feel transported into this space, right? Mm-hmm. Does that require imagination and work on our part, or is it just the genius of the creators that just drags us and puts us in this new world of make-believe?
I would say it's a bit of both. I would say that human beings are excellent abstract thinkers. You could infer from cave paintings that we evolved this ability to think abstractly, you know, planning for the hunt on the cave wall or planning for our nomadic movement, thinking about the seasons and time and kind of conquering our environment required a lot of abstract thinking. And so narrative is essential to facilitate group movements around abstract thinking. So we are wired to suspend disbelief when narratives are compelling enough, right? When they can trick us into believing they're real in that moment, allowing us to kind of strategize for the future. And VR does the same thing. You see a big object moving in a large portion of your field of view. That matters for survival. We have evolved tendencies to pay attention to stuff that might eat us.
Absolutely, yes.
Yeah, so same thing with film.
You're not waiting for the whole metaverse to be built. You are already in it, and in fact, you teach a class.
Yeah.
Right? Tell us about this class.
Oh, I'm so happy about this class. We now have this class where my students and I meet, not just in person, but also in VR. And then we'll spend most of our time in VR together. We talk about VR in VR together. And of course, that's a bit recursive. It justifies the use of VR. But I really see this class as proof that teaching in VR on most any subject, depending on, of course, the pedagogical design, is possible and likely better than teaching on Zoom. And so it could be, we could just transport ourselves, let's say, into a Greek pantheon, and let's say that was the subject of the day, and we could talk about it in situ in a virtual environment where the visual stimuli relate to the intellectual subject of the day. It could be a surgery, we could be in a medical facility, we could be on an oil rig talking about, you know, the environment. It really seems like a flexible environment for pedagogical design. I'm super excited about it. Yeah.
What about gender interactions?
Oh, yeah.
That's a topic that you study and you care deeply about. Mm-hmm. Tell us, what have you learned about gender interactions in online, in these compelling online spaces? What can we draw from that?
Yeah. Oh, this is such an interesting topic. People love to customize their avatar to represent themselves. Somewhat ironically, you know, we finally have this technology that allows us to be malleable, anyone we want to be. And most people make an avatar that looks pretty much like themselves.
Is that right? So do people stay true to their real life gender in terms of their avatar gender?
Their true gender. So their psychological gender. So most people just statistically are gendered and sexed consistently, right? Most people are cisgen. There are many people, though, for whom that's not the case. And for those people, avatars are one of the best use cases of presentation malleability, right? Mm-hmm. So we find that actually the two main categories for people who make avatars that they feel don't represent their, what we would call an actual self, as in the offline presentation, but a true self, then, you know, what you feel on the inside. The two categories are people who are psychologically gendered in a different way than they would normally present, and then people with physical disabilities, at least according to the research, who want to, you know, not have that as something that they present in the virtual world so they can explore in ways or not use that identity characteristic as the most important aspect of their definition. That said, I mean, an avatar should be able to represent anyone as they want. So, but getting back to gender, I think because gender is so malleable and flexible in virtual spaces, the cultural changes that we've seen with respect to gender over the past decade or so are not just an effect, but also a cause of the development of these technologies. I think they're mutually reinforcing. Mm-hmm. So I think gender fluidity, of course, is much more acceptable now from a kind of social and cultural standpoint offline. And that complements virtual worlds very well. People feel less beholden to their offline gender and a little more comfortable gender jumping, as we might call it. My research suggests that men have been historically more comfortable gender jumping than women in the video game context, possibly because men are more likely to perceive their avatar as a tool, whereas women at least according to the research, who play games historically have seen the avatar more as a reflection of an identity, and there's more social pressure on women to perform gender in a kind of normative way. And hopefully that double standard is changing, and also women are increasingly more experienced with video games, and we know that if you control for the amount of experience, then women and men play video games just as well as each other. They achieve the same levels of skill in the same amount of time. But for at least for competitive games, which historically have had three-dimensional worlds with avatars and fast-paced kind of interactions like shooters, men have played more than women. So if you just compared men and women without considering the amount of time of play, it does seem like men are more experienced, which would explain why they see the avatar more as a functional object as opposed to an identity signal. Maybe that's a long-winded way of kind of explaining why we've had some sex differences in the presentation of gender in avatar spaces in the past. But because of these cultural changes and the norms of gender, both offline and also online, I think we're seeing more of an equalization. I think we're moving toward an equalization when it comes to gender differences in gaming or metaverse contexts.
Offline versus online identities. I want to ask if people are naturally prone to being authentic in an online, in an immersive online environment. The way I present myself to you offline, would I present the same way in an online environment?
That's a really good question. And there's one study that comes to mind which did find that people are more authentic communicating with strangers online than they were in person. But remember, in that study, it's only strangers. So there's the strangers on a train phenomenon. Do you know this one?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, so you meet someone on a train, you're never going to meet again, you're going to different places. You tell them everything.
Yes, spill the beans.
Exactly. I never told anyone this, but this one time I stole from the store or whatever it was. So your most embarrassing secrets, because there's that sense of anonymity. And so online, you potentially feel even less connected to your identity and your reputation, the potential to be recognized again, etc. So you might feel freer to express who you are. But this notion gets quite complicated by many other factors, right? Because the social norms of a virtual space are very important, of any space, right? Mm-hmm. The social norm of you and I sitting here is formal and professional. And if we were in VR together doing exactly this interview, we would have the same social norms. And so if, however, we were surfing or something, right, like I'd be more relaxed, right? So I think in some ways, offline or online doesn't really matter as much as the social norm. So I think that will guide how people behave more so than actually the medium of communication, mm-hmm, when it comes to your identity and your self-concept.
Right. The malleability of identity, mm-hmm, I find that intriguing. Yeah. And you studied this, and you even have, that is a
phenomenon.
Yeah. It's coined
the Proteus effect.
Yeah. Tell us about this.
Oh, the Proteus effect. These days, I refer to it as my one true theoretical love. So that I remember when I'm off cheating with other theoretical passions, I have to come back to my one true theoretical love. We wrote a meta-analysis on this phenomenon not long ago, so I know there have been over 55 studies of this notion that when people use an avatar that presents certain identity characteristics, the people are likely to behave in ways that are consistent with those characteristics. And that's not just during avatar use, but after avatar use. So if you use a taller avatar in the virtual environment, you're more likely to negotiate aggressively on an economic kind of split task. You'll choose more money for yourself, less for other people, compared to using a shorter avatar. If you use a more attractive avatar, you'll choose more attractive dating partners. You'll stand closer to other people in a virtual environment. My favorite one is if you use an inventor avatar, it's wearing a lab coat
coat or has a clipboard, kind of signals of scientistness, you'll come up with more creative ideas in a brainstorming task compared to using an avatar that's just in street clothes. For exercise, if you use a healthy-looking avatar compared to one that's less fit, you'll exercise more afterwards. That one, at least one study found effects over a week later. Mm. So clearly something is happening here. Our meta-analysis found that overall, on average, this effect is reliable and consistent. The effect is higher for people in VR compared to studies that have just looked at flat screens, probably because that sense of embodiment, that sense that this avatar is my body, makes the effect stronger. My self-perception is malleable. My self-concept is malleable. And when I imagine myself, or when I observe myself doing things in the world, I kind of imagine or infer what my attitudes should be that are consistent with those behaviors. Well, if I observe myself in this avatar and I imagine other people seeing me in this avatar, then I subconsciously associate the characteristics of the avatar with my own identity. Just like if I observe myself sitting here in a studio with you, I'm making salient the psychological schema associated with being a researcher and a professor and a member of the communication arts and sciences community, et cetera. So all of those things are salient in my mind, and that is what's affecting my behavior, which is great in this context. This is what I need to be talking about. You don't need me to be talking about, you know, my Robbie as dad psychological schema in this context, unless of course we talk about my kids. But so it's a useful psychological kind of mechanism for guiding behavior. And now the avatar that we're using can trick us into doing things that are relevant to its identity characteristic. And this is great. We can get students to be more motivated in class, or people to choose healthier behaviors, people to be less toxic by giving them avatars that, you know, are associated with all these positive things. But on the downside, or the kind of the scary side, the dystopian side, we can get people to do things that might not be as healthy for them. We can nudge them toward extremist views or toward wasteful consumption, et cetera. So it's a powerful tool, and so we need to be careful with it. But it's also a fascinating area of research.
Absolutely. So the Proteus effect then would be a person can take on an identity. Mm-hmm. In an online environment and through an avatar or various other trappings. And then they start believing or acting in ways that conform to that identity that they have taken. Is that what Proteus effect
that could, is? That is. Yeah? That is. But the interesting piece here is even if you don't choose it, it can still affect your behavior.
Right.
Right? So you might not even know.
Inadvertently, you're just acting tall.
Mm-hmm. Let's use a different example. Let's say you're given the avatar with the McDonald's t-shirt. Mm-hmm. And then you're walking around the real world later on. You see McDonald's or Burger King. You might be more likely to choose McDonald's because your avatar had the McDonald's t-shirt, right? So it's potentially a tool for marketing in that regard. And that's a very simplistic example. But maybe you're wearing the broccoli t-shirt and then forget the fast food and you go over to Whole Foods and you buy some broccoli.
Or VeggieTales, maybe. Yes.
Yeah. I just saw there's a potential inquiry, third-party inquiry into Meta's investment in the metaverse. I don't know if you saw this in the news. And Meta, of course, doesn't want this inquiry to proceed because no media industry wants to be regulated or have outside kind of voices on what they can and can't do. Just like the movie industry created the MPAA and the games industry created the ESRB. Those are essentially, you know, the ratings labels. Those are not binding government rules. Those are kind of self-regulations. So we're going to need self-regulation from a metaverse industry, right? Or it could come out of the social media industry, but that needs to happen. And we need enough social pressure on these social media and metaverse companies to have oversight over their ethical implications and kind of effects in society.
As citizens then, that was my next question. Mm-hmm. How do we play this role? How can we influence policy? What can we do as citizens to have a say in the future of the metaverse?
Oh, yeah. I mean, if you care, you have to pay. And there are two ways we can pay. We can pay with our attention, right? And that's the most important. And I guess if you've listened this far in the podcast, you are paying the price of your attention. And thank you for that, because that's what we need, right? This is a major topic in the future of the well-being of our society. And so simply by paying with your attention and putting, you know, links out to articles that are critical and aware of these issues is important. The second ability to pay is with our tax dollars. And of course, that's an indirect mechanism. We need people in seats of power who want to put legislation or policy through that will funnel some tax money into pressuring these organizations to self-regulate. But I'm actually not a policy scholar. We've got great policy scholars here, though. And now that I'm saying these ideas out loud, I'm thinking, I should talk to the Coelho Center here in our department about this. It's a nice idea.
When developers or designers build new technologies, there's a lot of optimism. It's built on the intent to be very virtuous. Eventually, all technologies, vices tend to proliferate.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Right? So there is this interesting tussle between virtue and vice and how you define that. And
just because it's virtual doesn't make it virtuous.
Right?
That's a line in a rap that I wrote. Anyway,
I like that. Now walk us through, take the most utopian view. 5 years from now, the metaverse is arcing, trending in the right direction, and it's playing out as you would expect it. And then I'm going to ask you to think about the dystopian view, things spinning out. So give us the best case and the worst case scenario of the metaverse 5 years out.
Oh, these are great questions. This might be my favorite one so far. All right. So 5 years from now, utopia. So the price of the VR headsets has gone down to negligible. In fact, buy one, get one free. Mm. And so universities and workplaces around the world have adopted these. In doing so, the net reduction in carbon emissions has been excellent for climate change because people aren't traveling as much for work, and Zoom fatigue is diminished because we're no longer staring at these Zoom meetings. Access to education has increased dramatically because online education is no longer so tedious. The reluctance to adopt these technologies has gone by the wayside because they're super usable and all these accessibility features have been designed into them. Of course, also the base technology, the blockchain crypto side of the metaverse is operating extremely smoothly. Nobody's fighting over standards anymore, so we can move from one virtual space to another seamlessly with our virtual goods. That has generated a new market for virtual goods where we can more evenly distribute economic resources because some kid with the right technological skills with a computer in any country can generate NFTs that people can buy for their avatars and use all over the world, generating an income that kind of equalizes economic disparities. And of course, it doesn't matter if that kid is male or female or this religion or that religion or this government or that government. So we're moving toward a more egalitarian kind of world society because the metaverse has brought us together in a way that is economically viable and I don't know. What else is good? Oh, we're all healthier because it's not just VR, it's also AR. So it's nudging us toward getting outside and taking meetings while we're walking around with each other. And we're going a little too far in the utopian angle, but dystopian. So the dystopian question, I guess, is reliant on an assumption that the metaverse comes to be, but then, but we can't control it. It gets out of our hands. The technology is so decentralized and distributed that it develops a mind of its own, maybe almost literally. Like the AI that companies are generating get plugged into the metaverse. And because it's decentralized, it's hard to keep the AI from reflecting the very worst human tendencies. And so we end up with these social circles of extreme
extremely polarized, hateful groups that incite violence and reduce unity and create economic disparities that are irreconcilable because the power of governments have diminished in relation to, I mean, I'm just like spitting back Snow Crash or any other cyberpunk novel. And yeah, go ahead.
So the dystopian part, one is that real human agents have deteriorated in this online space, and they just sort of the base instincts that have taken over, and the virtuous goals have not been achieved. Mm-hmm. Another possibility is one evil actor is populating this virtual space with a bunch of other evil. They're not even real people, mm-hmm. but they're just fake, you know, autonomous AI agents that are spewing venom and acting in ways that are extremely corrosive.
Absolutely, absolutely. And to what end? Maybe to the end of humanity. Maybe someone decided to code up an AI whose job was to figure out how to destroy human beings, and that AI is spitting that corrosive vitriol in every direction, trying to incite violence and war and force people to launch nukes.
We'll set that aside. Yeah. But anyway, thank you, Ravi. This was a terrific, terrific session.
Yeah, ending on a dark note.
Yes. No, we will try and spin the episode to end on a positive note. But yeah, the annihilation of the human race is not the intended outcome here.
Let's hope it's very unlikely also. Out of curiosity, do you want to hear my Proteus Effect rap?
Oh, that'd be fantastic. Maybe you can share it with us.
Are you still rolling?
Oh yeah, we're rolling.
All right, ready? It's short. Please excuse this divergence. It might be odious. I hope I helped you learn, yes, about the Proteus Effect, yes, a phenomenon, which I've written many research papers on, and this nerdy song. The Proteus Effect is when your virtual self, yes, your avatar, changes how you think and act, and yes, that's bizarre, but replications we see in a diversity of contexts, e.g., taller avatars cause more aggressive negotiating, attractive avatars more confident online dating, dark-skinned avatars biased divesting, older avatars more future investing, healthy size avatars, exercise proclivity, inventor avatars, more creativity, gendered avatars, self-stereotyping, antisocial avatars, negatively griping. The list goes on. Effect size is relatively strong for a media effect phenomenon. And if you want details and stats, I know that there's a published meta-analysis. I wrote it. But let's discuss ethical implications. Avatars for influence or persuasion. I call it avatarification, related to gamification, but potentially more efficacious. Virtual you is a significant cue to affect your self-perception and direct what you do. It's an opportunity that is ripe to abuse, to push you toward crap you likely shouldn't choose. So let's be careful with the virtual self. Researchers, focus on education and health. Don't use the power for personal wealth or in stealth just to compel your clientele. Though I know technology inevitably is a double-edged sword, so we will definitely need to achieve new media literacies, especially as avatars are increasingly ubiquitous. So we must discuss what to trust. Just because it's virtual doesn't make it virtuous. I hope this little rap was not superfluous. And now you know the effect name, Proteus.
Ooh, move over, yeah! Snoop Dogg. Robbie's in the house.
Snoop nerd. Yes. I just thought of that because the virtuous thing. But it's also got that dystopian, exactly. Utopian balance. Yeah.
But thank you so much. This was just an absolute joy, a treat. You gave us so much interesting information and insights, and I'm absolutely delighted.
Thank you so much for having me. It's it's a real honor to be able to share some of my thoughts with you on this.
Thanks, Robbie. Life Meet Tech is presented by WKAR in association with Michigan State University. Executive producer, Melanie Paul. Audio engineer Drew Hill, and hosted by me, Prabhu David. Please subscribe wherever you're listening right now so you don't miss an episode. And I'll see you next time on Life Meet Tech.